2012, January 13. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 9, The Earth We Stand Upon. Today we're starting a new unit, Unit 3 of the course, in which we're now going to start diving into the real meat of what we're going to be studying. If we want to understand life elsewhere in the universe, we must first understand life on Earth. And so this unit is entitled Life on the Earth, and it's broken basically into three parts. First, we're going to be looking at the properties of the Earth as a planet. We're going to be looking at what properties it has that are going to inform us about what is it, maybe, that makes the Earth habitable. And we're going to use that as a basis for comparison when we later start exploring the possibility of life in the solar system. The second part, we'll look at the nature of life itself. And then it will seem somewhat discomforting because it won't seem much like an astronomy course, but more like a biology and, well, little tiny bit of biochemistry course. So this week is going to basically look like geology and atmospheric physics. Next couple weeks are going to look like biology. And then we're going to get a little bit of astronomy, you know, rocks hitting the Earth, things like that. But we're going to be looking at the history of the Earth, the history of life on Earth, and trying to see what lessons we can draw from that that helps us get a reasonable definition of what is life like and what is at least the only abode of life we know about the Earth. And today we're going to start that by looking in detail at the Earth as a planet. We're going to ask, what is the physical nature of the Earth? And so today's lecture is entitled, The Earth We Stand On. The basic idea of today's lecture is to get across the idea of what the structure of the Earth is. The first thing is that the Earth's interior is very strongly differentiated. It's very hot, very dense. It's got a rocky outer crust on top of a thick rocky mantle, and below that is an inner and outer core made primarily of molten iron. This outer iron core is actually going to be important to us because convection currents in that outer iron, molten iron core are going to be responsible for creating the Earth's magnetic field. Turns out, as we're going to see later, the Earth's magnetic field is one of many aspects of the Earth as a planet that actually helps make it a little bit habitable. The magnetic field acts as a kind of shield against high-energy particles coming in from outer space. We're then going to take a close look at the crust. The crust of the Earth is very active. It's one of the reasons why studying the history of the Earth is so difficult, because as we've mentioned before in talking about the age of the Earth is a very dynamic planet. In fact, the crust is broken up into 16 rigid tectonic plates that move and grind past each other. And it's at these plate boundaries that we get the locations of earthquakes, volcanoes, and the recycling of crustal rocks. So understanding something about the Earth as a planet is going to be telling us a number of things about some of the forces that are at work on our dynamic Earth, but also is going to tell us about where we're going to have to look and where we shouldn't be looking when we try to piece together the Earth's history, both its geologic history and the history of life upon the Earth. This is a view of the Earth from space. This is one of the new satellites that's sitting out in higher orbit that gives us these everyday beautiful views of the Earth. For those of you who own something like an Apple iPad, which I love mine, there's a wonderful new application now called Earth XD, which is a high-definition, real-time view of the Earth. Well, as real-time as you can get, around the entire globe showing weather and things like that. This is the kind of level of technology we have of being able to view the Earth. We've almost come to take this for granted, but in fact, this is a very recent innovation in human history. We never really saw our Earth as a planet until really the 1960s, when the first spacecraft left the Earth heading for the moon, and actually we turned around and looked back upon the Earth as a planet. We see this as a very tiny place, mostly covered with oceans, in the deep black of space. That theme is going to recur a lot. It's not only poetical and aesthetic, but it actually turns out to be an important aspect of the problem of life on the Earth. If we now sort of unwrap the Earth a bit and we make one of these nice planar projections of the Earth and use a computer trick that composites a lot of satellite images to get rid of all the clouds. So you look at all the cloudless days and you kind of composite it. This is what the surface of our Earth actually looks like. This is an actual photograph, just computer unwrapped, of the Earth as a planet. It's going to have a surface that's 71% liquid water in the form of the oceans, and the other 29% is in land surface area. This has not always been the case. In some times in the past, there have been more oceans, sometimes less. But right now we're living in a time when we are mostly a water planet. And really that's one of the real key aspects of the Earth that's going to be important to us. It is a place of primarily liquid water with solid land that life as we understand it stands upon. When we think of life, we think of things that crawl, we think of the fly, that walk. But in fact, most of the life is actually out in the dark zones here. Most of the life on Earth is marine life, and most of it is microscopic. take a look in detail at the surface of the earth, the solid bits of the earth, be it the crustal rocks on the continents or down on the bottom of the ocean, we find there's very, very strong differences in composition. The primary composition of the earth's crust is mostly silicates. Silicates are minerals made of silicon and oxygen. So silicon and oxygen are two of the most abundant elements that you find in the earth's solid crustal rock, followed by iron-rich materials like basalts here. This is actually a lava rock from Hawaii. It's a beautiful, dark, iron-rich lava, and there's a little magnesium-rich green crystals of olivine sitting in there. So these are all representing relatively heavy metals, as opposed to light metals like granites and quartz, which are mostly silicon oxide. They're silicates. Finally, we also get a lot of rocks on the Earth that are carbon-bearing or carbonaceous. For example, this beautiful photograph here of some limestone cliffs. This is material that's mostly carbon, in this case particularly calcium carbonate, locked up in the form of a solid mineral. That is going to be very important to us because the source of that carbon is primarily from the primordial Earth atmosphere, which was mostly carbon dioxide. So part of the fact that we find carbonaceous rocks tells us something about some of the physics that's going on, some of the geophysics that's going on the Earth that changes the composition not only of the Earth's surface but its atmosphere. So when we want to talk about the Earth, we have to not only talk about its solid surface but also its atmosphere. Today we're going to concentrate on the solid surface of the Earth. On Tuesday, we're going to pick up the subject of the atmosphere. And then later, when we talk about the Earth's climate history, we'll see how those two actually work together. If we sliced apart the early Earth and looked inside, we'd see a very different world than we see today. The Earth originally started out as mostly molten, and all the material was pretty evenly mixed together. What you're seeing in the molten original Earth is the composition of material that built the Earth, the tiny planetesimals that were assembled into the proto-Earth. However, those planetesimals are made of a mix of silicates and iron and nickel and magnesium and oxygen and all these other elements. But if you form a silicate, silicate's pretty lightweight stuff. It's the typical rock you pick up. Its density is about 2 or 3 times the density of water. Iron is a lot denser, more like 10 times the density of water, 8 times the density of water, depending upon the mix of stuff. So what you get very quickly in this liquid amalgam, that molten of junk that was the Earth, is the heavy stuff sinks to the bottom and the lighter stuff floats to the top. So the heavy iron, the heavy nickel and magnesium compounds tend to sink into the core, where the lighter silicates tend to float to the top and kind of like a fluff. This is very similar to a way of thinking about this, is go out and buy something like, you know, mint chip ice cream. So you get sort of low density milk fat and green, you know, well, usually it's green, not because mint is actually green, but you'll get green ice cream. And then running throughout that are little solid, dense chunks of chocolate chips. Now, when you buy it, the chocolate chips and the ice cream are pretty well mixed together. But, of course, what happens is your roommate goes in there, scoops out a couple bits, and then leaves it on the counter and walks away. It always seems to happen. What's going to happen? The ice cream melts. When the ice cream melts, the chocolate chips are all going to sink to the bottom, and the milk fats are going to sink to the top, and you're going to get this kind of this water green goo in between. That's a process referred to as differentiation. You go from a well-mixed state to a gravitational settling in which the heavy stuff sinks to the bottom and the light stuff floats to the top. So the same thing happened in the proto-Earth. The entire interior of the proto-Earth was molten. It was heated by the heat of formation. Piling all those rocks into the growing gravity of the Earth made them hot and molten. Eventually, what happens is you get a very strong differentiation. This even mix gets broken up. The iron and nickel all sinks to the very center, and the lightweight silicates all float up into the mantle and crust. And so you go from an evenly mixed Earth to a very strongly differentiated, multi-layered Earth. Let's take a little more close look at that multi-layered Earth by cutting a section here. This is a cartoon. It's approximately to scale. It's almost impossible to draw the scale of this and get all the details in because there's such a vast range involved. The Earth's diameter is about 6,370 kilometers. So if I go straight below my feet, it's 6,300 kilometers to the very center of the Earth, and then it was 6,370 out the back. So if I go down to the very center of the Earth, there's an inner solid iron core. It sits between about 5,000 and 6,000 kilometers all the way to the center, and it contains only about 2% of the mass of the Earth. So the iron's pretty heavy, but it's under extreme pressure. The temperature of this iron is close to 7,000 degrees Kelvin. That's hotter than the surface of the sun. And yet it's solid. Now, iron normally melts at about 1,000 degrees Kelvin. So why is it that iron is solid in the core? And the reason is because of the weight of the other 98% of the Earth's mass crushing down upon it. It puts it under extremely high pressure, and you get a phenomenon called pressure freezing. So you take something which is in room temperature and room pressure conditions, 7,000 degree Kelvin iron would be flashed into a nasty iron vapor. It'd be kind of like being standing next to an iron blast furnace over in Pittsburgh, back when they used to do steel. When you put it inside the deep earth, the pressure freezes it solid. When you get just a little bit above that core, you make a transition between solid and liquid. The pressure drops off a bit, the nature of the material changes. And you actually end up with a fairly large outer core. It contains 30% of the mass of the Earth is between the outer edge of the inner core and the outer edge of the outer core. Now, that's not a really good way to say that in English. It contains mostly molten iron and nickel. So this is the rest of the iron and junk that was evenly mixed with the silicates. Actually, it turns out that the initial Earth was probably about 32% iron and nickel, and the other 60-odd percent was silicon and oxygen and other stuff. So this iron is mostly sunk into the middle of the Earth, and its outer molten core turns out to be fairly important, because if you've got a liquid with a hot bottom and a cool top, it's going to start boiling. You're going to start getting slow-rolling circulation currents in there. But it's a metal, and it's electrically conductive. So it's dragging electrons along with it, and whenever you set electrons in kind of a rotary motion, you're going to generate electromagnetic fields. And so this is going to be very important to us, because the fact that this is molten and hasn't solidified or cooled off to be solid is going to be the place where we generate the Earth's magnetic field. Outside of that, containing about 67% the mass of the Earth is the mantle. It extends from about 100 kilometers below our feet down to the top of the outer core at about 2,900 kilometers. The way to think of the mantle is it's kind of halfway between a liquid and a solid. It's kind of mushy. If you really wanted to know what the consistency of the mantle was, think of silly putty or Play-Doh. It's kind of that kind of consistency, right? It's kind of pliable and loose, but if you hit it really hard, it will fracture. So it's not quite liquid, it's not quite solid. It's kind of this mushy gunk in between. Of course, it's at very high density and pressure, so it's really hot, but it's unusual material. This also, because it's mushy, it flows, but it flows really slowly. You get boiling motions in the mantle, but it can take a few million years for junk to well up from the bottom up to the top. So it's kind of this slow rolling gunk. Floating very much on top of that is a very, very thin transition layer. That's the white line. And then on top of that is the surface of the Earth, which are the very lightest weight silicates. So this is mostly silicates here, but the lightest of the silicates have floated all the way to the top. They're exposed on the surface. The pressure's off. They cool off, solidify, crystallize, and we get the crust of the Earth, which at its thickest portions is about 100 kilometers thick, maybe a few tens of kilometers thick, for example, in the deep ocean basins in the thinnest part of the crust. And that all sits and slips and slides on top of a thin transition layer that's made primarily of basalt, iron-rich material. Differentiation's not perfect. It's not 100%. While most of the iron has sunk to the core, there's still some iron hanging out in the upper portions, but it's now in the deep minority. It's a small fraction of everything, and you're primarily silicon and oxygen. Hydrogen and helium, which are part of the original raw materials of the solar system, are not common on the Earth. And the reason is because they're such lightweight atoms, they escape from the Earth's relatively weak gravity. That's a point we'll come to later when we look at atmospheres of other planets. But for now, we'll just simply show that the Earth is mostly silicates in a differentiated form, lightweight silicates on the top in the mantle and crust, heavy molten iron and nickel in the outer and inner core. Now, it's this outer core here that's really important to producing one of the features of the Earth. The Earth has a pretty hefty magnetic field. The Earth is, in fact, a gigantic electromagnet. Basically, the magnetic field is generated by these convection currents, these rolling, boiling motions in that outer molten core. You get what's called an electrical dynamo. Why this field is important to us is the field extends out beyond the Earth, out into interplanetary space, where it encounters a wind of particles, electrons and protons, that is continually flowing off of the sun that we call the solar wind. The solar wind comes in at fairly high speeds. It's a couple hundred kilometers a second, but it's really low density. And it's not really a big wind. It's kind of like a light breeze all the time. But those high energy particles would be impacting directly on the Earth's atmosphere all the time if it weren't for the magnetic fields. One of the things magnetic fields do is deflect charged particles. And so what you get is that the magnetic field stretches out towards the sun rams into it, and you kind of develop this long wake. It's almost like a magnetic or electromagnetic comet tail behind the Earth. So it acts as a kind of a shield. So a strong magnetic field turns out to be an interesting property of our planet. Now, there are places where high-energy particles can get through the sort of bow shock at the front and flow down through the poles. That's where the magnetic field lines kind of lead in down onto the magnetic poles of the Earth. And when that happens, they can impact the upper atmosphere. And when they impact the upper atmosphere, especially during like a solar storm, you get the really spectacular aurora borealis. This is a picture from earlier last year of an extremely spectacular all-sky aurora that was seen up in Norway and Sweden. Normally, you'd see a couple sheets. This was unusual. There was a very strong solar activity when this particular picture was taken. So the solar activity does get through, but it's largely shielded by the Earth's magnetic field. So this is something we're going to go looking for when we look at other planets. If it has a magnetic field, that plays a role in shielding the Earth's atmosphere from the impinging solar radiation and solar particle wind. That may have implications for keeping high-energy particles off the surface. High-energy particles have a bad tendency to do things like cause genetic mutations. They can also be continually blowing against the atmosphere and slowly ablate and burn off the atmosphere of a planet. So it sort of makes it hard for a planet to hang on to its atmosphere. So magnetic fields are going to turn out to be something important to go looking for when we look at other planets. How do we know about what's inside the Earth? I said that the Earth is strongly differentiated into layers, a dense, central, molten, and solid iron core surrounded by mushy silicate mantle and a thin silicate crust. How do I know that? I can't dig down in the Earth and take a core sample. I think the deepest holes that have ever been drilled are only beginning to approach 10 kilometers. And they got another 6,920 kilometers to go. The old science fiction of Jules Verne of a voyage to the center of the Earth, or that really awful movie a couple of years ago called The Core, ain't going to happen. So we have to have other ways to see inside the Earth. And the way we can do that is the Earth is very active geologically. And occasionally there are earthquakes, sudden releases of a tremendous amount of strain energy in places where the crust is either sliding past each other or colliding together. And when you smack something, you put a lot of energy into a single place, it radiates out. Some of you, so these folks over here could certainly feel the energy rattling through the table. If I got a really big weight and dropped it on the floor, other than the fact physical facilities would yell at me and probably fine me for damaging the floor, you'd all feel it down through your feet. That's energy being deposited in the solid material, and then waves go rolling out through the solid material. There are two kinds of waves that I can run through solid or liquid or semi-mushy material. They're called S waves or shear waves. Shear waves are where the material kind of does this. So this part gets pushed down, and it pulls down its neighbor and then springs back, which pulls down its neighbor and springs back, and I get a series of walking shearing waves because they're sort of rubbing material left to right. For example, water waves are a form of shearing wave, although actually the restoring force there is gravity rather than material forces, but the same basic idea applies. So I dump a bunch of energy here into this grid, and you see how that kind of rolls through. You know, slap the surface of a bathtub or a swimming pool, and you can make S waves pretty easily. So those are S or shearing waves. They have a wonderful property. They pass right through solids without any problem. But if there's any liquid phase in there, if you ever sort of try to excite water waves, water's kind of mushy, and it begins to damp. So while you can start a really big shear wave through water, it very quickly damps out because of the different pieces of the water rubbing against each other. Whereas when you have a solid lattice, you're basically moving the whole lattice together as you roll through it, and the damping is far less. So one of the properties of S waves that are very important is if you make shear waves in the Earth, it will blow through all the solid bits, but if it hits any liquid bits, whoop, they'll damp out. So that gives you a way of seeing a wave that passes through one state of material solid but not through another. It gives you a differentiation, ability to differentiate different materials within the Earth. The other form of wave is actually a very familiar wave. It's called a pressure wave or a P wave, or sometimes they're called compression waves. You're experiencing compression waves right now because that's what sound waves are. In this case, I'm moving little folds in my throat, making noise, and I'm making sound by making air compress and decompress forwards and backwards as it propagates along. So I get a bit of compression, which makes a little bit of a vacuum in front of it. It responds, and I get sort of a moving compression wave moving along. That happens in solid materials, in liquid materials, and in gases. P waves are pretty cool because they'll pass through anything, and they're very distinctive. A P wave, I'm going to see things kind of displace like this as a P wave rolls through me, back and forth. An S wave is an up and down motion. So I can distinguish a P wave and an S wave passing through me in the air. It's hard to make it S waves in the water, but air, but you can make them in water. Or I can make them in solid material, and I use a device called a seismograph to see them. So the difference is S waves only go through solids and get damped by liquids. P waves pass through both. So if I have a source of waves on one side, an earthquake on the other side of the Earth, directly below the Earth from me, it will make S waves and P waves. The S waves coming up will get damped out in the liquid part, and I won't see any S waves from right down below my feet, but the P waves will just pass right on through. Coming from those directions, there may be no liquid along those directions, and I see both the S and the P waves. So I put that information together, and this is how I can see inside the Earth. So I have an earthquake go off here. Boom. We've literally wired the Earth for seismographs. There's a lot of reasons for this. One is because earthquakes can be quite devastating. The other is one of the ways you can deposit a whole bunch of energy in the ground is to let off a nuclear weapon underground. And it's a way of figuring out, we could watch the Russians to see if they're cheating on the nuclear treaties. They can watch us to see if we're cheating on our nuclear treaties. So the Earth has been rimmed with extremely high sensitivity seismographs, primarily for watching to see if the other guys are cheating on their nuclear test agreements. And as a consequence, we have a wonderful network of seismographs for studying the interior of the Earth. So, in fact, a lot of knowledge about the interior of the Earth came from underground nuclear testing up through the 1950s and 60s, and now we have to rely on earthquakes every now and then. Even really tiny earthquakes now, the sensitivities are remarkable. So the S's and P waves go rolling out in all directions, and seismograph stations up in this zone here, where all the pathways, which are curved, they're curving because you're going through layers of different densities, so you get a little bit of refraction, just like refraction in water or glass, go through this. And these stations along this line here will see both S waves and P waves. But when I get here to the liquid outer core, what happens is I suddenly get into a shadow zone where I only get the P waves because the S waves hit the inner core and go boom and damp. Now, you have different earthquakes go off in different portions. You can then reconstruct in three dimensions the interior of the Earth. It's kind of like CAT scanning, except you're using energy waves, P waves and S waves, seismic waves going through the Earth. Now, here's an example of some of these waves going through the Earth. They don't just go through once. Sometimes they rattle around a couple times. You may remember a number of years ago, there was that tremendous earthquake in Indonesia that caused that terrible tsunami that killed about 250,000 people. It actually caused a series of seismic waves to rattle around the Earth. These are different stations. This is a station in Ecuador, Diego Garcia, the Indian Ocean, Papua New Guinea, Alaska, California, Easter Island, and Ecuador. You can see the waves running through the Earth as these waves from this tremendous magnitude 8 earthquake went woof, 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 woof around the Earth a couple times. So this is how we know what the interior of the Earth looks like. The earthquakes produce seismic waves. We measure them with sensitive seismographs. We use the network of seismographs around the Earth to literally reconstruct a three-dimensional tomography of the Earth's interior. So most of the knowledge we have comes from that. We can play this game on other planets. We've put seismographs, for example, on all the moon landers. So we played a similar game with moonquakes, although the sources of moonquakes are different and include, among them, meteor impacts on the surface. Mars is less well instrumented with seismographs, but one plan for future Mars exploration would be to equip every single lander with a high-precision seismograph and tie them together into an ultimate network, and we could actually probe the center of Mars doing that. Other planets, we have to use more indirect techniques, kind of guess what the structure is based on models of the planets and their materials are made of. But let's come back to the Earth. So we look at the Earth's crust. The Earth's crust is not a single solid piece. It would be nice if it was, just a single solid eggshell. The Earth would be geologically kind of boring for the most part. But in fact, the Earth's crust is brittle and rigid and broken up into 16 rigid plates that float on top of the mantle. They're kind of lubricated around by this rich basaltic lava that sits in a transition zone between them, and they kind of slip and slide laterally around. This is often referred to as lateral tectonism, because the crust is literally able to slide around on the body of the Earth. The lateral refers to side-by-side motions. There are two kinds of plates that we see on the Earth. The first of these are the so-called oceanic plates. They live in the bottoms of the seafloors in the vast ocean basins. These are the thinnest crusts in the plates, and they also turn out to be geologically the youngest. We can do radioactive age dating of them, and some of them are only a few million years old. Some of them are forming even as we watch at some of the boundaries. They tend to be very thin, between 5 and 10 kilometers deep. So attempts to dig down into the Earth's crust to try to get into the transition layer between the crust and the mantle is all being done with deep ocean drilling. And hopefully the idea is, in some of those places, in a few years, the Russians are really big on this, is the hope is to be able to punch through the bottom of the crust into the transition zone between the crust and the mantle and actually sample material down there. Out in the continents, like what we're standing on here, are the so-called continental plates. These are the oldest and thickest parts of the crust. They range between about 20 and 70 kilometers thickness. Some places, just isolated places, can be up to 100 kilometers in thickness. But kind of a good average is between 20, kind of out at the edges where you get the boundary, say, between a continental and an oceanic plate. But once you get deep into the continental plate, you're really going to be really thick. There's an awful lot of rock between you and the transition zone with the mantle. The plates really float on this very complex transition zone. And this transition zone, called the upper mantle, turns out to be fairly important for a number of phenomena we care about. It's a semi-liquid environment under fairly high pressure, lots of dissolved gases. It's basaltic, which means it's fairly rich in iron and magnesium, in addition to having silicates. And it's molten. It's liquid, or at least really kind of mushy. But every now and then, there'll be cracks in the crust. These molten bits will work their way up through the crust, break through the surface. That's what a volcano is. So volcanoes are a pathway for getting material from the upper mantle up to the surface. And this is brand new, young material. Or it's one of the ways that we can do it. The other thing it does is it sort of forms kind of a slippery lubrication that allows the mantles to slide back and forth, or the crustal plates slide back and forth on top of the mantle. So it isn't just like we've got an Earth's crust that is simply a broken eggshell broken into 16 pieces, but is constantly sliding around, grinding next to each other laterally. So here's that map of the Earth unwrapped. We erase the oceans and get them out of the way so we can see what the bottom of the ocean basins look like. So we've now taken that original picture of the Earth, we've taken away the water, and now we can see what the ocean bottoms look like. And we see all the hidden sea mountain ranges, and we can see that the Earth is broken up into 16 of these plates. Some of them are quite big, like the Pacific Plate. We live on the North America Plate. There's a South American Plate, the Nazca Plate. There's all kinds of plates running around in here. These plate boundaries between these 16 tectonic plates turn out to be interesting from the point of view of geologic activity. Let's take this same map, but now I'm going to overlay a bunch of yellow dots. Each yellow dot is the epicenter of an earthquake. And this is now taking into account a few decades of seismic observations of the Earth. One of the first things you notice is earthquakes preferentially happen along the boundaries between plates. Now, places like Ohio, we're right over here, do occasionally get earthquakes. Remember, some of you may have felt the big earthquake that hit now in the eastern United States near Washington, D.C. That's actually, I think it's one of these spots here. You can get sudden strain relief of deep inside the Earth continental crust producing earthquakes, but those are relatively rare. You can see that the real pileup is along these various boundaries between the plates. For example, the boundary between the Pacific Plate and the North America Plate. That boundary is the outlines, among other things, the famous San Andreas Fault through California. Also, we end up with a very strong series of plate boundaries in South America. The entire western coast of South America is just earthquake country. It makes California look calm. So this is earthquakes. Earthquakes tend to happen preferentially, but not always, along the plate boundaries. Now let's, instead of plotting the earthquakes, I plot the sites of volcanic eruptions. Everything from little tiny burps to big things like Mount St. Helens blowing its top, or the Chaitén volcano in Chile a couple of years ago, and Mauna Loa out on the Big Island of Hawaii. What you see again is volcanoes can happen in the middle of continents. There are active volcanoes. One of these is Kilimanjaro. There's Mauna Kea. Out in the middle of the plates, these are very different kinds of volcanoes. But most of the volcanoes seem to occur. These are also major volcanic eruptions. We continue to outline these along this Pacific area, often referred to as the Ring of Fire that surrounds the Pacific Plate. So volcanism, the welling of material up from the deep interior, making its way to the surface, is one of the primary means by which the Earth's surface is repaved. That's going to occur primarily along plate boundaries. So let's look more carefully at these plate boundaries and see if we can't understand what's going on. First of all, how do they move? What is the motive force that's causing these plates to slip back and forth? Well, the answer turns out to be that mushy mantle. That mushy mantle is semi-liquid. It's hot on the bottom, cool on the top. Whenever you get a liquid that's hot on the bottom and cool on the top, the hot material rises against gravity and the cooler material falls, and pretty soon you set up circulation patterns. That circulation is called convection. It's exactly the same convection as the same boiling you get in a pot of water. It's hot on the bottom, cool on the top, and you get instabilities that eventually set up circulation patterns. The circulation pattern, however, is very slow. And as the circulation pattern runs, it actually rubs against the bottom of the plate. And this is a sticky boundary. So the convection slowly drags on the upper plate that's sitting riding on top of it. So if I had two convection currents rolling like this, say this current and this current, next to two plates, and they're exactly lined up, this current's dragging the plate this way towards me, the other current's dragging the other plate towards me as well. And the meeting point is they're dragging them together. If the convection was running in a different way, like this, where they're rolling up like this, it's going to drag the plates apart. And you can imagine the plates might be along the direction. You might get plates being dragged side by side. So the speeds are pretty slow. I mean, I'm doing this sort of rolling my hands around at speeds of a couple meters per second. We're talking about centimeters per year of speed. So the plate's here, wait a year, it's there, wait a year, it's there. It's really hard to measure this. You need long time baselines and ultra-precise global positioning system, but it can be done. So the plates are constantly sliding along really slow, centimeters per year. They can do three things. They can collide, they can be pulled apart, and they can slip past each other. And each of those boundaries has slightly different properties. So, you know, on human timescales, it doesn't seem like a big deal. It's barely moving at all. But if we go into geologic time, which we've already shown is really deep, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, it means the face of the Earth has changed dramatically over its history. Here's a simulation of the last 600 million years of continental drift, of the sliding of plate against plate along the Earth. 600 million years ago is an important number to us. It's going to repeat here in just a second. There's today. Now, boom. This is the emergence of life in the Precambrian period, and this is today. So we can see that the continents, you can sort of see the shapes of North America and South America and Africa and Asia kind of come about. Watch this little thing right there. That's the Indian subcontinent mashing up into the Himalayas. The fact that South Africa and Africa and South America seem to fit together like puzzle pieces, that wasn't just an illusion. They really do, in fact, fit together like puzzle pieces. There's South America and Africa pulling apart. They're at a place where the boundaries were pulling apart over time. So this idea of continental drift is very important. The face of the Earth is changing constantly. The Earth is a very, very dynamic planet. So what goes on along these boundaries? Well, there's three of these boundaries that are of interest to us. The first of these are called transform boundaries. Transform boundaries are where the plates are sliding past each other laterally. A good example of that is the boundary between the Pacific Plate and the North America Plate, which forms, among other things, the San Andreas Fault. Those two plates are pretty much even continental plates. They kind of stick together, and they stick. But there's forces dragging them. The strain builds up until suddenly one day, boom, they jump about 5-6 meters. You make the Earth jump 5 or 6 meters, things kind of shake. In 1906, a jump of about 5 meters just north of San Francisco destroyed the city. I grew up along the Owens Valley Fault, actually the Garlock Fault. I grew up in a little place right about here in the Mojave Desert. Every now and then, the world would jump around a little bit because of deep breaks down inside the Garlock or the Owens Fault. So these side-by-side faults can be quite dramatic. Here is actually the boundary between, on the left, the Pacific Plate, and on the right, the North America Plate. The Pacific Plate is slowly sliding to the north. The North America Plate is slowly sliding to the south, actually kind of the southeast. So a very, very long time in the distant future, Los Angeles will be roughly on par with San Francisco Bay. Actually, they'll kind of meet about halfway in the middle down around here on Bakersfield. So whatever you may see, bad disaster movies that have Los Angeles falling into the ocean, wrong direction. All Los Angeles does is lurch about 5 meters to the north. Of course, if it lurches 5 meters to the north, it flattens a city of a few million people, so it's going to be a bad thing. When I lived in L.A., the big one was always coming this year, and I don't want to be around when the big one hits. It's going to be bad. But this is, in fact, an example of a transform fault boundary. Sliding past each other, you get these so-called slip-strike faults. A convergent boundary is where the two plates are starting to mash together. So the convection currents drag them together. If the boundary between them is, for example, an oceanic plate and a continental plate, the thin oceanic plate is shoved below or subducted below the continental plate. So, for example, along the Pacific coast of South America, the Nazca plate in the Pacific is getting shoved down below the South America plate. In Japan, the Japan Trench is the Pacific plate, which is sort of slowly rolling off to the west, running into the Eurasian continental plate, and they get shoved down there. Again, one plate gets shoved below, solid material gets pushed into the deep interior and melted. This is one piece of the recycling of the Earth's crust. Formerly old solid material gets pushed into the deep Earth and gets melted. All its clocks get reset in terms of a radioactive sense. So this becomes future crust to pop up somewhere else. These deep faults mean that you're now going to get sticking in a roughly vertical position. So it builds up, bang, and then you get a very large vertical motion. When that happens, as it did a little over a year ago, just off the coast of Japan, in the so-called Tohoku earthquake, so here's the Pacific plate moving this way, the Eurasian plate moving this way, and the Philippines plate moving this way, so, you know, Japan really gets it. Magnitude 9 earthquake caused that terrible tsunami and all that destruction up in Japan. That was actually caused by the seafloor suddenly changing and dropping by a certain amount. The water drops down, and then it comes back. Same thing happened in Indonesia a few years ago. So these subduction zones, the place where one plate's going underneath another, are some of the most devastating earthquakes we get on the Earth because of the strong vertical motions. So we've got plates sliding by each other, plates crashing together. There's got to be one more place, and that's got to be plates pulling apart. These are called divergent boundaries because the two plates are diverging away from each other. It's where the plates are being pulled apart by convection currents that go in the opposite direction to those that push them together. A good example of that are the mid-ocean ridges, rift valleys and continents, for example, the African Rift Valley. You open up cracks in the crust, these can become points for volcanoes to well up. Similarly, you can get pulling apart into the deep ocean, and you get these so-called mid-ocean ridges. This is the famous Atlantic mid-ocean ridge. If you look down and you sample rocks as you move from the crack boundaries outwards, you start out very young, brand new crust, just rolling to the surface and solidifying. But as you move further and further out, the radioactive age dates get older and older and older. And that's a way you can trace literally millions of years of the motions of these plates by looking at the ages of the rocks inside of them. These mid-ocean ridges can also be the places of some really wonderful active volcanism. The entire island of Iceland is being built at the crack between the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, between the North American and Eurasian plate, and is a site of extremely active volcanoes, hot springs, and all kinds of wonderful stuff going on today. Iceland would not exist except for this plate. This is some of the youngest terrain on the Earth along this plate boundary. So places where the plates are, you get strong sticks for the convergent boundaries, or the transform boundaries become the sites of strong earthquakes. You get a few earthquakes here, but they're mostly of the volcanic fracturing sort. You get a lot of volcanism along these plates because you get a lot of molten material, you get cracks in the crust, and stuff wells up. But we also see that there can be earthquakes in the middle of crustal plates. The earthquake in the eastern United States and the one in Ohio a few months ago is deep inside the Earth, just basically strain building up and breaking. But you never really, except in very, very rare circumstances, get superquakes in the middle of continental plates. Similarly, you can also get volcanism in the middle of plates. And the reason you can get volcanism, especially on oceanic plates, is because the oceanic plates are very, very thin. They're only 5 to 10 kilometers thick. So you can build up a magma hotspot just underneath one part of the Pacific plate. Way out in the middle of the Pacific, there's a little hot spot of magma. The Pacific plate is generally rolling in this kind of sort of west-northwest direction. So over the course of many millions of years, a crack opens when it's sitting on top of the hot spot. The hot spot's about right here on top of the Big Island of Hawaii. Actually, it's just a little bit off the southeastern coast. There's a little tiny sea volcano, which someday will become the island of Lauihi. The island of Hawaii is still sitting on one section of that hot spot. That's the active volcano Mauna Kea, or Mauna Loa. Next to it is the extinct volcano Mauna Kea. All the other Hawaiian islands also have volcanoes, but they're dead because they've moved off the hot spot. You go up the line to Midway Island. It's also part of this chain. A lot of them, not all of them, broke through the surface. There's a long chain of undersea and above sea islands, which are all ancient volcanoes. At some point in the past, the plate changed directions. And so you can actually see a kink, the so-called Emperor Seamount. So if we look at one of these maps of the undersea, the hot spot's just right here, just off the southeast coast of Hawaii, on top of Lauihi and Mauna Loa. Kauai is where the hot spot was a couple million years ago, Midway Island. But sometime in the past, the plate was moving in a different direction. The plate was moving vertically over this hot spot. So you end up with these hot spot volcanoes. These hot spot volcanoes build up what are called, backing up a bit, so-called shield volcanoes. Here's a good example with Midway, which is really old and completely eroded down, is where the volcanoes just simply pile up until they look like kind of like an old-fashioned Greek shield that a warrior would hold as protection. So we often see shield volcanoes. Shield volcanoes are very different than these emergent rift volcanoes that you get at convergent boundaries. So we can find volcanoes on the Earth. I can tell a shield volcano from a simple upwelling, a subduction or collision zone volcano. They look different geologically. They have different kinds of geological output and different geological shapes. So this is going to be something we can look for on other planets. Do I see shield volcanoes? No volcanoes at all will be a clue to the presence of tectonics. So the real takeaways from today's lecture is that the Earth is not just sitting there. It's a dynamic, evolving planet. It's changing constantly. The face of the Earth, when most of the complex life first arose during the Cambrian period, 600 million years ago, does not even barely resembles the Earth we see from space today. The Earth's crust has been constantly being reshaped, repaved, renewed by tectonic activity, working over billions of years, abetted by weathering forces from water and air. Most of the surface, as a consequence, is relatively young, a few tens to a few hundreds of millions of years old. As I mentioned before, the average age of the Earth's crust is about 100 million years old, even though our whole planet is about 4.5 billion years old. The reason why it's still active today is because its interior is still hot. 80% of this heating, I'll just mention as an aside, comes from radioactive heating. So the Earth is big enough that it can stay molten in its interior. This tectonism is going to turn out to be important to us because it's one piece of the puzzle of Earth's habitability. It turns out to be one of the drivers, not just of changes of surface geology, but as we're going to see going into next week's lecture, it's one of the drivers of the evolution of our atmosphere and our climate. So the dynamic Earth is one of the pieces. If the Earth was an old, cold, dead planet, it might also be dead as not a place where life can live. Maybe planetary tectonic activity is a prerequisite for life. Who knows? We're going to see, take that idea and run with it as we look out in the solar system. Any questions? Okay, well, enjoy your weekend, and I will see you all on Tuesday.